You know how people sometimes book trips to Alaska in the summertime to take in the sights while it's relatively warm? Not nearly as many people would think of spending time in the far north in the winter when light and warmth are hard to come by. Our guest this hour spent 6 years inside the Arctic Circle and not in Alaska either. Laura Galloway tells of her time in far northern Norway in her memoir, Dalvi, 6 years in the Arctic Tundra. Laura Galloway is a writer and communications strategist with degrees in political science and indigenous journalism. Laura's work includes a stint at the Los Angeles Times. Laura Galloway, thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Jeff. I'm really happy to be here.
It's a pleasure to have you. And let's ask the first question I'm sure many people ask you. What were you thinking?
Well, my time in the Arctic really started, the catalyst was a DNA test. Many years ago, I had taken a very early stage commercial DNA test, which suggested that I shared some DNA with the Sami people. And I thought I had been a very well-traveled person. I'd been around the world, and I had never heard of Sami people. And I had no idea that Scandinavia had an indigenous population. And so I started learning about the Sami people. I read about them. I was fascinated. I had been living in New York City at the time, having a very, very fast-paced, frenetic life, a career in media. And I took a trip to the Arctic, and I absolutely loved it. It was the complete opposite of absolutely everything that existed in New York. And we had just, it was total nothingness. And I loved it. And I kept taking more and more trips back to the Arctic. Eventually, I met a reindeer herder and developed a relationship and decided to move to the north of Norway to his village for a few months only, but I did bring my cats with me. And the 6 months from New York, and the 6 months, around the 6 month mark, the reindeer herder left in the dead of night in my first winter. And I had a decision to make, would I stay or would I go? And my decision was to stay there alone. And I did for 6 years.
There's a real boing at the end of the introduction of the book. You write that in the sting of the cold, I also feel something foreign and unfamiliar, which I had thought had been lost to me long ago. A sense of wonder. That's a really profound statement. What had happened to your sense of wonder?
Yeah, I think that we live in such a connected world now, Jeff, that it's you know, you even can travel to different cities and you see the same stores in every city. And so much of the world is commercialized and the same, and people can often be, I was so jaded about everything, and here I was suddenly in a completely different culture, completely different language, completely different social customs, didn't know anything about how to handle the weather. The smallest utilitarian tasks in my day, from how do I pay rent in this place, to, you know, how do things work, to really big things about surviving in the seasons and being warmly dressed. And I hadn't had that feeling since I was a kid. You know, I will always consider myself to be lucky, as I hope a lot of your readers probably feel the same way, that or your listeners feel the same way, that it, you know, before the internet, travel was a totally different thing.
Yeah.
And half of it was the surprise. And that's really something that I found there.
So let's, I mean, it's interesting that the DNA test was one of the keys to unlock this new phase in your life. I mean, you know, some of us find cousins. You found like a whole world, in essence. But it's in contrast to the way things were dealt with in your house growing up. The past wasn't allowed in the house where I grew up. You're right. Why not?
That's right. I don't think that most people would have sort of looked at a test that indicated that you had some ancient connection to someone and on one part of the family. And I mean we're all related at the end of the day. But I had grown up in a household. My mother had died when I was 3.5 years old. My father remarried a woman that was not so interested in the kids that came from my mother. And I had a tumultuous and difficult home life because of that, and not ever feeling like I belonged and constantly being reminded that I didn't belong, and you know, that I was not blood. And I think that this really, really kind of inspired my need and this bigger need to find a place to connect and a place to feel like I belonged somewhere or I had a sense of connection or home. And that was the driver. And I think in New York, things had come to a point where, you know, my identity was wrapped around my job and what I was doing professionally and, you know, the people that I was around and what I wore and really stupid, superfluous stuff. And then I lost my biggest client. And then I didn't have, there goes my work identity. So I think all of these things that I had sort of been, you know, pushing against and really trying to bottle up came to a head for me. And that is, you know, I think why this was an essential time for me to kind of figure out how my childhood had affected my adulthood.
So the cold never bothered you, being from Indiana, you tell us in the book. What did strike you upon arriving there? Not to visit, that's a different story, but to stay. I mean, here you are, you and your cats, Rennie and Boo, and their containers and everything. And what are you thinking?
I think that the most interesting thing for me overall was that that Sami culture is a culture within a culture. So if you meet Sami people, then they will tell you that the land area in which they live is called Sápmi, and they precede the modern borders of Arctic Finland, Sweden, Norway, and the Kola Peninsula of Russia. And so although they might be affiliated with these countries and be citizens of these countries, there is also Sami culture, which is a completely different culture in terms of societal norms and ways of doing things. And you can get language books and try to learn the language, but there are no manuals for how things are done or on a day-to-day basis and interactions. So a good example of this that I write about in my book is that I'm a Midwesterner. We hug you when you leave. We do big goodbyes. We do five goodbyes. You know, we're leaving now. Bye at the door. Bye at the car. Goodbye. You know,
yeah.
And this is a huge extended sort of leaving, right? And if you go to a party and you're in New York, you always thank the host. Or a party in Oregon, you thank the host before you leave. You don't do that in this culture. And the first time that I had met my partner, Ailu's family, everybody was gathered. It was about 20 people. And I went to hug all of the kids, and they just looked absolutely mortified. And it was explained to me that they thought that I was leaving forever or I was about to die or something horrible was going to happen, because you just slip out. You just never know when you're going to come and go, so you don't punctuate goodbyes. And the same thing goes with scheduling. You know, usually I'm very precise about where I need to be and what time I need to do this. Because life is so still guided, or there are remnants of life that was guided by nature, which can be changing. You just don't, you know, you don't make promises about where you can be or I'll pick you up at 4:00. So I spent a lot of time just thinking, oh, I've been blown off. Because I didn't understand this is sort of, you know, the way it goes.
So culture aside, did you speak any of the languages in use in Sápmi when you got there?
No, I didn't at all. I enrolled in Sami language school, and it's a very complicated language. You know, at the time, I'm a woman in my 40s and just I didn't have an aptitude for language, and this language is closely related to Finnish, if anybody knows how difficult that language is. It's a different structure. So I started to learn the language intensively, but it was complicated by the fact that the few textbooks that did exist teaching Sami were actually the language of instruction was either Swedish or Norwegian, and I did not speak those languages. So I had a really tough time trying to learn.
And it is Sami, not Sami, right?
You can say it either way. Mm-hmm. I think it becomes a regional pronunciation issue.
Okay. And was I close with Dalvi as the title of the book?
Well, I want to tell you that I think you are incredible. You said Cautacano perfectly. Did you just read that and said that? You said
I did,
Dowdy
yeah. Thanks to my mom for sounding out sounds, yeah. So interesting thing about SAPMI is that when we've avoided using the term so far because apparently it's somewhat offensive to the Sami people, but they don't want to be called Laplanders.
They don't want to be called Lapish. Mm-hmm. That's a big no-no. You can call them Sami people, but I think Laplander is not as bad as calling somebody, you know, a Lap or Lapish, uh-huh. But I would stick to Sami people.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about what drew you there. I mean, obviously there was the DNA test that let you know that you had some Sami blood way back there. You met Ailu at a wedding, which was interesting enough. And you had been married before, and I think people need to hear this. Oh my God, how were you served divorce papers?
Oh God, you can ask that. That was one of the worst days of my life. Oh, I there was a buzz. There was a buzz at my door of our apartment, and I thought, you know, there was somebody standing there with roses, and I thought, this is great. We're really, you know, I had never thought I would be somebody that would be getting divorcing this person, and they were divorce papers. It was a completely shocking day, and I'm sure that many people can kind of have had similar stories, but yeah.
Indeed. I appreciate that you shared that in the book, but it was just one of those things that, oh my God, really? So this is, you know, a good indication of like, wow, these are one of many things that had gone wrong. And the book does oscillate between, you know, your current situation in SAPMI and then back to Indiana and other parts of your life. Let's talk about then arriving to stay more or less in Cautacano. I mean, you brought your cats, Rennie and Boo. Ailu had a dog. I mean, talk about relationships with animals there and revelations about that.
So very different relationship with animals. Dogs are considered to be partners in work as opposed to pets. So reindeer herders always have a dog, and they're good to them, but they're not good in the let's go buy outfits for the dog kind of way. When the reindeer herder eats on the mountain, the dog eats. It's just a different, you know, it's really a partner in survival in that part of the world. And also, I think because it is a modern culture, I want to say, but with a very traditional underpinning and traditions that still do exist. And are very, very alive. And I came from a place where I love animals, and my animals are rescues. I don't know, at the top of the hour, I was just mortified that one of my reindeer herding dogs was barking. I don't know if you could hear that.
Just a little bit.
But, yes, apologies. But so it was a big difference, and because I would see animals often that I would develop an empathy for, it was hard sometimes to see animals outside in the cold. I developed a habit of kind of bringing them into my apartment at night and feeding them hot dogs and things and quietly letting them out in the morning.
It would not have been approved by the neighbors if you'd done that?
I just think I was really a curiosity for bringing two cats from New York. I mean, first of all, what is a New Yorker doing in this tiny village? And then on top of that, she dragged these two cats, put cats on an airplane, trains and airplanes, and what was that all about? Mm-hmm. So I think that people saw me that I had a very different approach to animals.
Laura Galloway is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Her book about moving to the Arctic Circle, Norway, and the land known as Sápmi is told in her book, Dalvi, 6 Years in the Arctic Tundra. You're welcome to join our conversation on the exchange by phone, 800-838-3760, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned some of the cultural differences, the language barrier, obviously. Let's talk about Cautacano more broadly here. I mean, you report it, it's economically depressed or was at the time. I mean, what are the mainstays of the economy or were anyway?
Well, there are two big villages in Norway that are primarily the traditional centers of reindeer herding, and they're Cautacano, which, by the way, is Gaudegaidnu in Sami, but I would not make you say that word, and Karajok, which is Karajoka. And about 10% of, not all Sami people are reindeer herders. About 10% of them are. And I lived in the inland, you know, up on the Finnmark Plateau reindeer herding part. So mostly everybody has somebody in their family that's reindeer herding full time. But then it's really just keeping a small village going. So many people are teachers or municipal administrators or working in the grocery store, or, you know, there are jobs like that. But it's also been increasingly difficult for people to follow their traditional livelihoods just because of, you know, this is a culture that very much is tied to the land, and reindeer herding requires land. And that's often in competition with what the government wants to do with the land, which is mining. It's a very, very mineral rich area. Wind farms, which take up reindeer herding, you know, grazing land. So this has really switched things. And I think that young people are faced with the reality that a lot of them will not be able to do this as their full-time occupation.
And what are the reindeer used for? We haven't asked that yet.
The reindeer are used for food, and people eat them. And they are in Norway. It's a very expensive food if you're actually outside of the north. It's a staple food in the north. They're used for food. The skins are very, very much used in clothing still. I mean, I wore reindeer boots. They're the warmest boots you will ever wear, you know, in very cold temperatures like minus 40 or 50. And you know, people are making art with the antlers, and you know, they're used for all manner of things. They try to use every part of the animal.
So you mentioned the since Ailu was a reindeer herder, the man you were living with, that he was gone for long periods of time. He couldn't tell you when he was going to be back, that sort of thing. What did you do for employment at first?
So I did a tiny bit of consulting. Thank goodness for Skype, and also the fastest thing happens to be up in the north of Norway. But then I really had to figure out, and a big part of my book is sort of like, what do you do when you commit to living in a new place? And because the jobs that I had done really, really meant nothing, or, you know, my media career, who I had worked with, I did everything I could just to make money. So that included, I ended up going back to my original career a million years ago and started doing some reporting for the local Norwegian language Sami newspaper, which the editor of that paper translated all of my articles. And I ended up teaching for one semester in the reindeer herding high school, which there is actually a reindeer herding high school, which teaches all the traditional subjects for kids that are going to go into university, but teaches reindeer herders really important things about, about reindeer herding, the economics of reindeer herding. How do you interact with government offices? What permits do you need? And because I had spent a lot of time with the reindeer and my partner and with other people in the village, I had developed a pretty good vocabulary of single words I knew the words in Sami and I knew the correlations in English. And it was really important to me to, when I was teaching English, to try and help everybody learn that language because of, you know, the future of tourism. And also so they can tell their own stories.
Well, that's all. But interesting. I can imagine, though, that the phase in which you can only sort of point at things and say the word you know and not have a whole sentence to put it in.
Yeah. Exhausting.
Yeah. We've only touched briefly on how awful living with your stepmother was at times, and the general gloom of your formative years. So, when you dared to think after a while in Kautokeino of you and Ailu getting married, where did your thoughts go?
I just was thinking what a juxtaposition that would be from the life that I had been living previously. And also I was thinking about my family would think that this is just completely, But, you know, that really never happened because we broke up after six. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you mentioned the difference in the culture, like, you know, the no five-part goodbye when you say goodbye to people like you did in Indiana, where, you know, because people know they're going to see you again soon, and that's expected in a culture like this, I guess, where people see each other all the time. But I didn't know whether to laugh or cry as you tell the story of meeting with the rector of the university. What did you go see her about, and how different were your demeanors?
Well, it was funny because and this is really I would say more of a Scandinavian attribute as opposed to just something Sami or Norwegian or Swedish. There's something that's not an actual law, but it's called Law of Jante, which is basically it's a cultural way of doing things, which is that you don't stick out, you don't call attention to yourself, you don't brag. And I was used to being this aggressive entrepreneurial go-getter, and I thought, oh well, I can put this university on the map, and all they need is to have me handle their media. So I scheduled a meeting with the rector and was, you know, gave my ideas and gave my CV, and I've done this and this and this, and she just looked at me stony-faced because this was just like exactly how you do not act in a situation when you're meeting someone, just as you for a meeting. It just seemed really egocentric, and nobody ever tells you, but nobody told me, if you have a problem with something, you don't complain or say, I want to speak to the manager or go to the top. And I read in a very funny book called The Xenophobe's Guide to Norway that if a Norwegian hears somebody complaining, that they think that you're either foreign or crazy or both. So So these were big differences.
So before we get to a break, I do want to establish that Ailu broke up with you basically through Facebook message. I mean, departures had obviously not been sweet in your life. I mean, what did you think at that point? Did you think, I said, I'm going back to New York, or was there instantly some sense of maybe not?
The first thing was I couldn't really... I had to deal with it right away because I had practicalities. It was the middle of winter. How do I make sure that I keep this apartment? How do I, you know, get firewood? And then I just decided, and it was, I guess, just having a sense of pride as much as anything. I had traveled so far and I had so much to learn that I just wasn't going to sort of just slink away. And, you know, I felt like I had lessons to learn there, and that's why I stayed.
So we just talked about Ailu, your reindeer herder boyfriend, breaking up with you just 6 months into your time in Kautokeino. There were practicalities to consider, like, how do I get to stay here? You got the apartment put in your name instead of his. That helped. Alone in an Arctic winter is one thing, but the other part of it is, who did you have for just company after the breakup?
I did end up spending a lot of time alone during that period, also because I was new in town and I didn't feel like there were many people. You just don't confide in people with things like that. So I talked to friends occasionally, but felt quite distant about that. It was a time that I was very much alone and, you know, having to hold a lot in, mm-hmm. But, you know, I made it through and there we go.
You did, but, you know, as we pointed out in earlier parts of the discussion, you had a pretty rough childhood. Your mother died young. Your stepmother was not exactly the warmest and most receptive person to her husband's kids from the earlier marriage. And then there's a point in the book where past and present collide. You tell your father and your stepmother that you and Ailu broke up, and it produces quite a reaction from her and then from you. What happened there?
I think everything that I had held back my entire life never, you know, I think when you come from a difficult childhood and you don't feel secure about being in your home, which was the case for me, there was never, ever, ever any physical abuse. But I was in a place where I saw my siblings one after the other become, they were all sent away, you know, to go live in other places or sent to schools far away. And so you always have a sense of, I'm not I'm not really safe here. So I was always trying to maintain my position and you know, be the good girl who didn't get sent away. I lived in terror of that. And I had capitulated so much my entire life that I just, in this one moment on the phone call, I just decided to talk back to my stepmother. And I think a lot of rage came out in that call that I had held back for many, many years, because she, you know, you would expect that a parent would give you support or comfort when their child or adult, even their adult child, has gone through a breakup. But her, you know, she had quite a bit of contempt for me. And so I just, it was a difficult phone call.
But. Yeah, of all the things to say to somebody who's just gone through a breakup, it's, well, you're going to pay us back, aren't you? And you explode. And believe me, I think any other reader, as I did, is going to go, you go, girl, when you're finally giving it. But this did represent a turning point for you, didn't it?
It did, because I realized that I had to have a sense of personal agency, and that I, you know, was responsible for myself and for standing up for myself. And if you can't stand up for yourself, it's really hard to have somebody else do it. And I had just sort of reached that point. So.
All right. So not the only tough situation, obviously, when you're alone in the Arctic. Then Boo, your cat, who you brought with you from New York, escapes from the apartment, which is traumatic. Yeah. And this goes on for months. But it seemed like it improved your social life and your connections with the community somewhat.
It did. I think so. Yes, my cat was adopted from a shelter in Harlem, and he had never been out before. And he got through a window and just completely disappeared. And I think he got very lost very quickly, because in the summer, the reeds and the grasses are very, very high. And it was horrifying to me, because, you know, somebody who had a mother who, I have mother issues. Somebody, I'm always afraid of abandoned animals or children, or, you know, this is really a trigger for me. And when Boo got lost, I was beside myself. And that's really when people in the village started coming forward and really trying to help me find him. And, you know, I think a bit of a spoiler, if people ever go on my Instagram, so I feel it's fine to tell you here, that Boo ended up coming back after 3.5 months or some enormous amount of time. And it was one of the best days of my life. But the period in which he was gone was just harrowing.
Yeah,
and you're wondering how he was surviving.
Yes, as we all were reading the book, as anybody will be when they read the book, and I'll keep a bunch of the secrets beyond that in the back of the book. But but there's the subtitle: 6 years in the Arctic Tundra. I mean, so you would have, I think, had a few times along the way when you would have thought of bailing and going back to New York or Indiana or pretty much any place but Kautokeino. So talk about the things that kept you there.
Well, you know, I did make really amazing friendships and develop amazing relationships there. I ended up taking a master's degree in Indigenous journalism. I am not an Indigenous person, and I have an entire chapter of my book that says I am not a Sami. Just because if you share some DNA with a group, it does not make you that person. But I wanted to really understand Sami culture better, and I wanted to be better with the way that I communicated my ideas about the place. So I ended up taking a master's degree there. I was in the first cohort of the Indigenous journalism program. I made a lot of friends in the village, and also I really, really reconnected with nature in an extremely profound way. And it changed my life. I'm not a person that was ever able to meditate. I'm highly ADD. And just when you are walking, and then I adopted dogs, when you're walking every day for 3 hours, you can't help but just sort of revel in the spectacular nature. And it really had a very healing and transformative effect on me.
So was the program in Indigenous journalism in the Sami language?
Oh gosh, no! It was in English. It was the first, because they had people coming from kind of around the world, so it had to be in English. And I never would have survived doing a master's thesis in semi language.
Okay, that's why I asked the question. Although early on there, I mean, I think when you were still with ILU, that that you appeared on Norwegian TV. Were you speaking in the Sami language?
Yes, I was. I was, and but really, you know, really simple sentences that any 5-year old could you know throw out. Mm-hmm. So no great shakes there, but.
But there you were on NRK, the Norwegian network, the Sami network, I guess, of NRK.
Yes.
But yeah, so all of Norway got to see you, or potentially did?
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
So we mentioned the newspaper publisher who gave you some stuff to work with and translated your stuff into Norwegian. And his name was Stein. And there's another person in the book who approaches you across a parking lot not long after the breakup. And you must have stuck out like a sore thumb for, is it Stein or Stina to approach you?
In Norwegian, so it's actually Stein.
Stein, okay.
But Stein ended up being a terrific friend and mentor to me. And then another woman called Stina, uh-huh. Actually, who was a Norwegian who had moved up north and was living with the reindeer herder. Very, very lovely and open woman. Just, you know, completely came toward me and introduced herself and pulled me into her fold. And I'm forever grateful for the friendships like that and the Sami people that actually ended up becoming to whom I became quite close also.
So you mentioned the reserve, and we've talked about it a couple times now about the, you know, you don't go hugging people willy nilly in the Sami culture.
Right.
But was there some sort of did you find a middle ground with some of the Sami friends you made?
Yes, when you get to know Northerners well, then you are free to kind of have more exchanges like that. But it takes a long time to build relationships, and it's very, I think you really see that, I think, everywhere in the North. And the only cold culture, not that I haven't been to Antarctica, but I've spent some time in Greenland. Greenlanders are completely open and will hug you. Huh. But it's just in the North, it does take time. And you do develop relationships, and you can more, you know, sort of be who you are and less on your guard. But I think it's really important to also, it was important for me to really understand, because I think as great as I thought I was at understanding other cultures and being respectful and all of this stuff, you really have to learn the things that aren't in books when you're with a new culture. Mm-hmm. And it takes time. And the American, and I don't want to say this about all Americans, but this is definitely me, that, you know, just to be aggressively, and that might be partially because I'm a Midwesterner too, aggressively friendly and helpful to everyone, that's not always something that people want. And that was a big lesson for me, and I'm glad I learned it.
You mentioned The Xenophobe's Guide to Norway. Had you read that before you went up there, or is that an after-the-fact kind of thing?
I found it in an airport bookshop in Oslo, and I really laughed when I read that sentence, and I thought, wow, I wish I had found this book 4 years earlier.
We have barely talked about the weather, and you mentioned temperatures a couple times, and warm reindeer boots, and not minding the cold that much, because it can get pretty harsh in Indiana. But I mean, what was a typical winter day like there, and how did you navigate in the cold and dark?
Well, in the middle of winter, it's not unusual for it to be minus 40 or 50, and 40 is the point at which Celsius and Fahrenheit become the same. So. Oh. So those temperatures are not unusual in the winter, and you really have to know how to dress for that kind of cold. The reindeer boots that Sami people wear are so warm. They're better than anything modern that you would ever find. They're hand sewn. You fill them with woolen inserts and also a grass that is harvested and dried during the autumn, and that keeps you really warm. It's really important to to keep your nose covered up and your mouth covered up, because those are two places where you can get really cold. Mm-hmm. And the most surprising thing about cold is that your hair actually freezes. You have a lot of water in your hair. It's very weird to see your hair kind of go into a million shards of icicles.
That's amazing. When you consider the parts of your life, Laura, I mean, is there anything that would have indicated that, A, you would go to SAPMI, and B, that you would come to like it as much as you clearly did?
No, nothing at all. I mean, I think I just rolled with it. And I think it was so important for me, because the biggest lesson that I learned is that, you know, home is not a place. It is a state of mind, and it's not, you know, blood and bones family. It's finding people that care about you, and finding people, building relationships. And I found that all over this village. And I also realized in writing this book, because as you said earlier, past and present intersect. I weave them together in this book, so the reader can really understand why I would be motivated to make such a huge change in my life. And also, I think for anyone that writes a memoir, you're really trying to make sense of things. And I realized in writing the book how incredibly lucky I've been my entire life, that people have just dropped in and been there for me. And I've had amazing friends and mentors and just the right people at the right time. And I think getting the full picture of that was an amazing thing to sort of recognize.
You mentioned that the muffled barking we heard earlier was from one of your reindeer herding dogs. So tell people where you live now.
So I live in England now. I don't want to say you have to buy my book to hear the ending of my story, but I moved a couple of years ago just because I felt like my time there had kind of ended. Mm-hmm. I met someone who I've been with, who is British. And so I made a big transition, drove from the Arctic with my two reindeer herding dogs and my two cats in all the way the length of Europe down to England, where I live now.
Wow.
And
it's an inspiring story, though, to really about finding yourself in a place where it's hard to find a lot of things. But there it was, light and warmth in a place that's very cold and dark. Dalvi, 6 Years in the Arctic Tundra by Laura Galloway. Laura, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Been a pleasure.